From runasradio.com, you're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell. This is Brandon Wen announcing show number 506, SQL Q&A from SQL Intersection Las Vegas, recorded Friday, October 28th, 2016. Run As Radio is produced each week by Pwop Productions, providing professional media and podcasting services online at pwop.com. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Thank you, Brandon. This is Richard Campbell, and thanks for listening to Run As Radio. We are live. Actually, this is a recording. We're not live, but we're together at SQL Intersection in Las Vegas. I have the usual suspects and a few extras. Is that Bob Ward? There's Bob Ward. So we're going to do a SQL Q&A for about an hour, the longest Run As we do, mostly because of Kimberly's answers. Right. Do you guys want to set the ground rules, or I'm just going to keep talking?
Wait, I want to set the ground rules, but before I set the ground rules, we have kind of some interesting things happening today, including Tim Radney's birthday. So I wanted this to be on the recording. Maybe we can sing, although you won't want me to sing nowhere near this microphone. Happy birthday. Can we do that? Because we've even got little cupcakes for Tim.
Cakes for Tim.
All right, one, two, three.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Tim. Happy birthday to you. Oh.
29. Well done, Tim.
All right, so this is going to get interesting.
Sober now, but so setting the ground rules. We'll talk about anything SQL, anything diving, anything sports. No, we want to focus on SQL, but fair game is virtually any topic. We listed some of the ones that are we're
now
the
looking
most passionate
at the
about.
Slide of doom.
The slide of doom, the eye test slide. But these are the topics that we think would make the most sense. But there's a ton of stuff that you've learned this week. Maybe you want further clarification of something. And what's going to happen is Richard's going to get his workout for the day. He's going to run around. You'll raise your hand, ask a question, and then we'll point to whoever should answer that question, and then the other ones will sit down.
Yeah, so the trick to making a good podcast is to have everybody that's speaking actually on a microphone. I know. Stop me if I'm getting too technical. If you throw your hand up, I am watching for you, and I will run. I'll signal to you. I will run to you. I'll put the microphone in front of you. We can get your question, and then Kim can spend a long time answering.
And as an incentive, everybody that asks the question, we have a nice little Microsoft USB power charger thing for you.
Nice. Loot. We don't normally get loot. Where will we start? Are there any immediate questions? Right on the front row makes it easy.
Thank you. What's a good native SQL restore strategy? I know it's a vague question, but I was, you know, getting more into how do we ensure, other than, you know, checksum, verify only, and things of that nature, how do we constantly, in a large environment, what would be a good way to go about doing restores and ensuring that all the backups are fine?
You kind of hit the nail on the head, which is, once you've taken your backups, you need to be basically restoring them to make sure that they work.
There's no other evidence that matters, right?
Right.
Until you've restored it, you don't really know it works?
Until you've actually restored the backup, you don't know that you've got a good backup. So a good backup strategy is really based on what your restore strategy needs to be, which is figuring out what you need to be able to restore to get back up and running within your downtime and data loss service level agreements, and then retrofit that back to driving what your backups are actually going to be. Now, in terms of testing your backups, there's basically no shortcuts. It's whatever systems are your most critical, they're the ones that get prioritized for the testing, especially if you've got a large org where you can't test absolutely everything, because that's just practical reality. That's it, really.
Yeah, because I would think if I restored the database and then tried to compare it to the original, something's happened on the original in the meantime, hopefully.
You're not going to be able to do that. So if you want to make sure you've got page checksums turned on for all of your databases, you want to make sure that you're backing up with checksum. So that tests all the page checksums and puts a checksum on the backup itself. So at the very least, you can then do a restore verify only with checksum. Okay.
All right. Got another question in the back, even though I'm blinded by that projector. Hi there. What's your question?
Are there any changes in 2016 that benefit specifically the analytical service or SSAS?
Great question.
I'm definitely not claiming to be an analysis services expert, but yes, specifically around performance, mostly around tabular mode, but most of the changes that occur on SSIS are around performance optimizations, specifically around tabular. So yes, there are some changes in SSIS, specifically for 16.
All the way back to the front.
I've got a production TempDB that's expanded greatly, twice its size, and actually ran out of room, messages in SQL Server. How do I start to analyze that? What's doing it?
Okay, so what I would do is, there's a DMB you can use called sys.dmdb task space usage. Okay? I would put in some code that is going to look at that, say, every 10 seconds or so. Okay? And I've got a script on my blog that'll do that for you. And the script will show the thread that's doing it, and also a graphical query plan pointer, and the SQL text that's being executed, right? So if you put that in an agent job, have it running every 10 seconds or so, and if it finds the task space usage total more than a certain number, you can filter to whatever you want, dump that into a table in MSDB, and then have another job that runs every hour that looks at that table and says, was anything discovered in the last hour? Sends you an email, you then have a list of all like the stored procs and stuff that are taking up space. That gives you the culprits. Now, inside those, go into that code, and what I would do is the same kind of code based on DMDB task space usage. Every time you're seeing a temp table being created, okay, put in a, here's how much space we're using so far, and a number. Okay, and then all the way through the code, put those in. You go in and you run that SP, and you'll get a list of all of the points where the temp tables are created with a number, so you can identify it in the code, and how much space has been taken up in TempDB. Then you can go back and figure out which of your temp tables is causing it to blow out. Now, if it's not that, you could use DMDB file space usage and check that your version store is not growing out of control. And so if you look in the transactions perfmon object for version stores at databases, in one of the perfmon objects, it's either transactions, databases, or access methods. There's a version, maybe it's access methods, there's a version store generation rate, version store cleanup rate. And if you're seeing that your version store generation rate is bigger than your cleanup rate, then something's causing the version store to get hogged. And there's a bunch of version store DMVs talked about in a versioning white paper that Kimberly wrote for 2005 that you can go in and look and see which one of your queries is causing the version store to grow, if that is the culprit. So those are the main two things I would look for.
The third one would be just internal TempDB usage from sorts or hashes, right? Yeah, so if you looked at what Paul's talking about, you could look at some of those plans. If you've got large sorts or large hash operations, those could also generate TempDB usage as well.
Actually, just to add to that too, a lot of hash operations, a lot of people don't realize that if you've got 20 people running the same aggregate at the same time, that's 20 work tables in TempDB. It's not one that they share. So you can, depending on the workload, wildly vary on your impact and usage for TempDB. So it really can vary over time as to what your problems are in TempDB as well. So you really do need to do much more regular monitoring.
Now, as a corollary question, sometimes people say, I've got a TempDB log that's growing out of control, and I can't figure out what's going on, right? So if you look at the DM Tran database transactions DMV, you can see all the transactions that are running, and you can scope that down to just TempDB. You can see how long they've been running, and I've got a script on my blog. If you Google or Bing for open transactions with text and plans, you'll get that script, right? And the problem is, though, you'll run that, and you'll see maybe there's one transaction that's been sitting there, and it's hardly generated anything. But your TempDB is growing out of control. What's going on? If that transaction has changed something in TempDB, then from that point onwards, the TempDB log cannot clear. So what's actually happened is you've got a long-running transaction that's not done very much, and then a whole bunch of other small stuff's happened, and that's caused the log to grow. So you don't actually have like a transaction that's caused a lot of log growth per se, but you've got a transaction that's holding the log active and lots of other stuff has happened. That's a very common scenario where people beat their heads off a brick wall trying to figure out why is my TempDB log grown so much. So you get two answers for the price of one.
All right, I got a question over here.
Hi, how are you? First, I want to say thank you because you guys helped us out when we actually put in our availabilities group. Glenn Berry was awesome.
Oh, thank you.
We're going to be upgrading from 2012 to 2014 in our availability groups. Is there any big gotchas we got to worry about?
Let me just ask first, is there any particular reason why you're going 12 to 14 and not 12 to 16?
Our developer won't support 2016.
Wait. Oh, they won't support 2016.
No, they say it's not supported yet.
Oh, some application maybe isn't supported. Gotcha. All right. So that's fine. That was just a tangent that I wanted to say. Right now, if you haven't put a lot of effort already into 12 or 14, almost no matter what version you're on, even back to 2005, 2008, you can backup restore to 2016. And I would put your effort into testing that much more than I would the other versions, because there's three key features that I just love. One is totally only available in 2016. That's Query Store. Column Store, even though it is available in 2012 and 2014, I'm sorry, Bob, I love it more, way more in 2016. So I would much rather motivate you for 2016 rather than the others. But it is there. It's just more limited in its use cases. But 2016, it's very wide in its use cases. And then Hekaton in memory tables is also a lot less restricted as it was in prior releases. So feature, like those three features. So, you know, I would try to work with that vendor and so forth to see if they are coming closer to certifying and allowing 2016, so you can go straight without putting a lot of effort into something that might have some limitations in certain areas. So, but having said that, the problem is I'm not a real AG person, so we've got a couple of other people. So
thank you for that. Now back to the actual question. The answer is
thank you.
I'm with you on the 2016. The only reason I didn't go there is because this is our primary application, and without them certifying, it would be my butt.
Sure. The answer to your original question is no. Nothing you should be aware of, basically. Nothing you should be scared of going from 2012 to 14 on AGs. Tim wants to say something.
Now, with 2014, there are some improvements, and then you also get the additional replicas, so you go from 4 to 8. So, improvements, but nothing, no big gotcha.
So no negatives, just more of goodness.
Right. No, like more that. Licensing that you can buy.
That's a guy with cake. Questions? Over there. Of course, on the other side.
You really
do the exercise. I do need the exercise. I'm going to have to run.
Run, Forrest, run.
I think I saw your arm first, sir.
I have a lot of small servers out in the field, and we really need to get these servers where the databases are encrypted. And it seems very expensive for us to go to enterprise with these small servers. Is enterprise going to be the only edition that's ever going to allow encryption in the database?
Microsoft has to answer.
Yeah. Yeah, let's give that one to the Microsoft
guy.
Oh,
wait a minute. I'm the Microsoft guy in this. Sorry. I can't give you any guidance on direction other than what we have right now for Enterprise Edition than what we're doing right now with encryption.
So a secondary question then, you're not going to like this question, but
it's okay.
I'm having a hard time finding vendors that want to play in that small space. They all want to supply me enterprise-wide solutions, which are extremely expensive too. Any right. suggestions?
You're not the only person that has come with that feedback about that kind of type functionality for doing it, like I say, I'm assuming you were like on Standard Edition, is that correct? You're looking for Standard Edition, right? Yeah.
And even some vendors don't work with the R2 standard. You got to be, with 2008 standard, you got to be R2 and above. So I'm finding all kinds of restrictions. I just
out of curiosity, for those folks you're talking about, those vendors, are they also don't want to move to like SQL 2016 as well? Is that also possibly a problem? Because
it's because of the expense, you know.
Right, but even if we thought about doing like what you're talking about, and by the way, people give us feedback a lot about the enterprise versus standard feature functionality. Even if we did something like that, though, seems unlikely we'd do that at lower releases, right? So I'm just curious, were that even going to help you in your situation?
Well, so far I'm finding like companies that. Like there may be one guy on the beach in Asia that supports his tool or once again, I'm getting to, very, very large enterprise vendors that don't even want to talk to us unless they want to talk to VPs. They don't want to talk to me. They want to see, you know, somebody with $1 million on the table. So
can I push on this a different way, Bob?
Sure.
Because I think this is what you're actually saying is like if, and you would never say this because you work for Microsoft. And
so you're
going to
say it for me?
So what if SQL 2016 standard did offer encryption? Would that encourage you to upgrade to 2016?
Yes, it would.
Great feedback.
Like that a lot. And just to go on another tangent related to that, as a guy who's dealing with encryption and things fairly often, what about other encryption solutions? Like what if I BitLockered the drive that SQL Server is running on? I mean, I'm not sure it would have any impact on performance, but, you know, what if we did?
Sure, but you're only BitLockering the actual disk itself. You're not BitLockering pages in memory or things across the wire or even the actual SQL Server data. If somebody could actually unencrypt the BitLocker, right, device, they could get into the SQL files, right? So, yes, BitLocker could encrypt the drive, and that can help you, but only data at rest, right, for that drive.
Right.
All right. I'm going to take a close question because I'm a little sweaty from the last one.
Here you go, sir. Just a quick question about high availability in standard edition now, the availability groups. Is it the idea of that to get rid of database mirroring?
So your question is the idea of now in SQL 2016 allowing availability groups for standard edition to have a single replica, is the idea to get rid of mirroring? And the answer is it is mark deprecated. Mirroring is mark deprecated as a functionality, which means at a certain point in time, as we normally do at our leisure, we decide to actually, remove the release, right? We're actually not really sometimes consistent about that. You know, always availability groups is our direction. So certainly database mirroring is supported even in SQL 2016, but availability groups is the future direction. That's where all our enhancements are going. And one of the reasons we did make that change was because mirroring supported that very type functionality and standard.
This one's kind of for Kimberly, I think, because... In one of your classes, you mentioned that you generally don't want to go with option unknown because you're going to take the average value. What is the downside? Because my thought is that if you go average unknown and your data is very uneven, right? You have some values that are very, very high and then a bunch that are under the average value, right? Isn't it better to allocate a little bit more memory to the query rather than trying to go, oh, well, I guessed at one and I have to allocate more?
Okay, but the issue with option optimized for unknown is that what you're doing is you're saying, I don't want to look at the actual value that somebody is supplying and get a plan specific to that value. I'm just going to go take the average. And my issue where it could be negative is the average, might be right across the middle and your data might be so skewed that the average is actually not good for anybody. And that's where I get concerned. If data is very jagged, it's not even that there's outliers. There's just no consistency. Data's all over the map. Average might be kind of good for no one. And that's my issue. I'm not saying it's bad and I'm not saying it's something to avoid. It's just something that I think people use because they think, oh, I'm going to get a general plan. And general plan is the wrong way to phrase it. It's an average plan based on average distributions and densities, which can be great, especially if your data is either relatively even or you don't access a lot of the outliers as often. You're accessing more of a consistent, closer to average set of values. Then the plan could be good. So I'm not against unknown. I just think that it's something that is not going to work for every scenario. And unfortunately, I've seen some people tout it as do this all the time because it's much better. And even though parameter sniffing can lead to problems, often parameter sniffing also leads for the values that were sniffed, a plan that's really good for those values. So parameter sniffing's not bad. It's only when you generate the plan and then use it for subsequent combinations of parameters that it might be bad. And that's what we have to analyze is what is the pattern of that procedure and then which option would be best. So I'm not against it. I it's not the option to use all the time. Does that help?
Yeah, that helps. Okay. Just a really small esoteric.
That was relatively short. Oh, you.
Small piece of trivia on that one. Is it more expensive to have a query that estimates one and go a little bit above or to have one that goes a little bit high on the memory allocation for the query and just kind of waste it, so to speak?
It's not just memory allocation. It's because that's usually related to things that are going to have work tables and so forth. I think of it more as what the cost is of processing. And you could, I think we talked a little bit about this too, but you could kind of overestimate rows and go with a plan that handles larger data sets like table scans. And that would often be a lot better than if you had heavily underestimated, gone with an index, and then had a value that was so high, you ended up doing massively random access and bookmark lookups against the table. Because the bookmark lookups on billions of rows would be far worse than just having done table scan, table scan, table scan, like all the time. So one could argue going with the more expensive plan for almost any set might be better and more consistent, but unfortunately it wouldn't lead you to any good plans for any of the more selective sets. So sometimes the better scenario is to not necessarily keep just one plan, but to instead even programmatically look at the parameters being passed in, build things more dynamically, and end up maybe even, you know, when these parameters are passed, it generates this statement, which goes into cache. And when these parameters are passed, it generates this statement, which goes into cache. So you end up actually having 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 or 8 different statements in the cache that all have their own independent plans that might be more specific. So what do you want? Yeah, I don't trust them. Yeah, oh, they're timing me again. So there isn't a single way to deal with stored procedures that's really simple. And I, if this helps, especially for people listening that aren't here, or even if you were, I did do a blog post series called Building High Performance Procedures. And I talk a little bit about kind of how to deal with procedures and sometimes let them compile and sometimes actually cache them and do it more programmatically based on which parameters and even sometimes the characteristics of those parameters. And that's really, I think, useful for a lot of folks. But there isn't a single simple way to take these complicated procedures with 50 parameters and then just put one plan in cache. And sometimes recompiling every time is good, but that has problems. So sometimes a hybrid solution is the best solution. It's tough though. But I kind of agree, aiming a little higher, allocating more might be cheaper than getting one of these plans that thinks that there aren't very many rows, but then there are. So I guess I'm with you. It's just, that's not the way the optimizer works. The optimizer doesn't kind of go, well, let me go a little bit high on this so that even if it's low, it's not so bad. But if it's higher than this, it's really bad. So it's a great question.
That was that a new
oh,
record?
Stop it.
So to go along with that.
Yes. Keep the timer going. Thanks, Plus.
You said it more. She may have said this. You can use optimize for unknown and optimize for a value. So you'll get the average, but when the value that you get is passed in, then you will optimize for that value. So you could try to do that in a plan guide and then balance that out against a statement level recomp strategy. But you're going to have to bake it off. There's no silver bullet. You'll have to test it.
I ended up back on the other side. I'm going to grab a guy on the wing, and then we'll come back.
Hi. Again, to echo this gentleman, I'd like to say thank you for a wonderful event.
You're welcome. Thank you.
I come from an environment where, like, my everyday is a lot of SSIS. And I'm curious if, knowing that, you know, it seemed like this version of SQL was very heavy on engine level ads and things like that. I'm curious if the next version, is there anything on the horizon for SSIS and, for that matter, analysis services that you'd care to share with us? And I do have a question. It has to do with, I guess it's kind of a replication. I have about half dozen SSIS servers, and I'm wondering if there is a way to synchronize the catalog servers, the SSIS catalog databases across those servers. Thank you.
David? They're conferring. Okay. You got a good one. That's a good question.
Yeah, good question. I'd have to look into that one, honestly.
On the mic, David. Everybody wants to hear very clearly, I don't know.
I do not know that answer.
But do pursue him, because he will find the answer. Yeah. Hi, question?
Hi. I inherited a 10 gig database that has 10 data files. I'm thinking of consolidating it into maybe 2 or 3. What I want to find out is there any performance gain in having as many data files on a small database?
I thought you said perfect question for you. For a small database that size, I would say no, probably not. And in general, we say, okay, getting back to why you might want to have multiple files and file groups. So multiple file groups, there's 3 good reasons to have multiple file groups. The first reason, and probably the most important reason, is for targeted disaster recovery, right? The second reason would be for better manageability. Targeted disaster recovery would be you're able to restore a single file group, right? Or you're able to do a partial restore where you can restore your primary file group and say an OLTP file group and all your past data, for instance, you don't have to bring online. So then, second reason to have multiple file groups, manageability. If you have a large table and it's all in one file, then let's say you've got fragmentation on it and you've got one portion of the table that's getting fragmented, you've got to run rebuild or reorganize on that big clustered index, for instance. If you can split your clustered index up into multiple indexes using partitioning or even separate tables with a distributed partition view over the top of them, you can operate and remove fragmentation just on one portion of that table. Okay, so you get better performance there. You know, get the microphone, go away.
Updatable partition view, not distributed partition view. I just want to clarify.
What did I say?
You said distributed partition view.
I didn't. I said updatable.
You did. Okay.
No, I didn't really. I said this. No,
it is on record.
I did say distributed. Okay. I did. Yes. I know.
Married couples.
You're right, dear. Damn. And it's on a recording, too.
Yeah. Wow. This is a show. David's wrong and Kimberly's right. What's next? David doesn't know and Kimberly's right.
So, getting back to the question. So then the third reason, and this is a real distant last for having multiple file groups, not multiple files yet, is performance. Being able to take an isolated portion of your workload and put it on one specific portion of your IO subsystem. Okay. Now let's look at multiple files. The reason you want to have multiple files in a file group is for performance. Okay. And as a generalization, we say any new file group should have somewhere between 2 and 4 files. The absolute sweet spot for you is going to vary. Okay. So you're going to have to do some investigation, but 2 to 4 is a good starting point. Why do you get better performance? It's down to things like when a checkpoint happens, it's flushing out a whole bunch of data pages to the various files. If those files are on an IO subsystem that has, for instance, multiple drives underneath that volume, then you're making use of the parallelism at the IO subsystem level to get better throughput at the IO subsystem level. Depending on your IO subsystem and your workload, different numbers of files might be better for you or worse for you. So you're going to have to investigate. But for a 10 gig file with 10 files, that seems like total overkill. So you're doing the right thing, I think, by consolidating down into maybe 2 or 3 files.
That was up there, man. That's got to be one of your longest. I mean, it's weak compared to Kim, but long.
Weak? What? It was concise. Concise.
Concise. I'd say 4 minutes. All right, your question.
So first, I know that first part of this answer is going to be, it depends. But I was intrigued by the keynote today by Bob Ward.
Oh, no, that means
regarding
me.
the I think he said it was autopilot soft NUMA.
Auto soft NUMA, correct.
So we recently upgraded from machines that had 8 core NUMA nodes to 4 15 core NUMA nodes, and it's actually hyper-threaded. So now we have 4 30 core NUMA nodes.
Right.
Could we potentially be getting some additional performance if we go to an additional software NUMA of our own? So not, we're still on 2014 right now, but you know, would we see some boosts if we kind of subdivided our current hardware, our new hardware NUMA configuration?
So Paul just mentioned about one of the trace flags we have for the memory object part of my talk I talked about. So first of all, one thing you should know is that in 2014 SP2, we added that capability for AutoSoft NUMA into the service pack. So what I just described in 2016, you can take advantage of in Service Pack 2. Clearly, my talk was focused on 16,
yeah.
Which is why I didn't actually mention that, but it does exist. So yes, I would think you would take advantage of it. And in fact, remember what I said about AutoSoft NUMA. Anywhere in the server that we partition by node, you're going to take advantage of it. Paul mentioned this trace flag 8048, which is an example of us actually doing node partitioning for memory objects. What's interesting enough is also in Service Pack 2, the dynamic memory agent response is also in Service Pack 2. So even excellent. Then, we auto-partition by node in SP2 as well.
Okay, cool. Well, that made it really easy.
Thank you.
Thank you.
By the way, my timing, Richard, is like 30. I'm like,
oh, no,
this,
you're super
right?
Fast,
you know,
I, just FYI. Super fast. You rip it. There you go. Next question.
So I'm a DBA, but I actually have the most burning question that I got out of this session on SharePoint. I'm trying to open my mind, be better about SharePoint. And I went to a session where they said, turn off auto update stats. So, and Kimberly, I was in your session on statistics, and you kind of did a side vent on that. So, I'm kind of interested in more on that. And maybe a question for Bob, you know, do the SharePoint team trust the SQL team?
Ooh, whoa.
Okay.
Just a little side.
So, okay. So there's a lot of background in why SharePoint has recommended that auto create statistics and auto update statistics be turned off. One of the primary reasons outside of the one that Paul just mentioned, which I will not be saying for the recording, is that they, first of all, don't think that every SharePoint environment is going to have DBAs. And I get that. And they want to have an environment that is more easily managed by systems that don't have full-time DBAs that really understand what's going on when new statistics gets created and so forth. So I kind of get that insight, right? And that idea. But at the same time, they are becoming more relaxed with systems that are managed by DBAs. And they are starting to say, yeah, these options like auto-create statistics, auto-update statistics, you can use them. But I would still even say with auto-update, I would always have a job that manually updates the statistics automatically rather than letting auto-update. Now, auto-create, I'm a big fan of that. But the unfortunate thing of auto-create statistics is that you have to make sure they're getting updated as well. So however you're managing your statistics, you have to make sure they're getting updated. And the big problem a long time ago with SharePoint was that their timer job didn't do that correctly. So they said, let's turn off auto create statistics. Now their timer job does work. And most people's maintenance routines work. So we can get away with using auto create statistics. But the general recommendation is still more because there are so many SharePoint implementations that don't have DBAs that they don't fully tell you to leverage those features that they think are more complicated. Now, I disagree with that personally, but I get the idea. And I do get that there's a lot of SharePoint instances out there that don't have DBAs, that don't know what these features mean. So I see both sides of it, but I'll let a Microsoft person take that further if one of plus. Yeah, no, he's shaking his head. No, I ain't going to touch that one. Do you want to say anything? Yeah.
So I think the question for me was, does the SQL Server team trust the SharePoint team?
Other way around.
Oh, the SharePoint team. I would say that the SharePoint team trusts that the SQL Server team produces a great SQL Server product, and the SQL Server team trusts that the SharePoint team produces an amazing SharePoint product.
There's my answer.
Wow, that's such a politic answer.
How very diplomatic. Guy wants to keep his job.
Wait, let me add something before Paul gets on this, because I do want to say SharePoint was originally not a Microsoft product, and it was purchased, and it started out, you know, on a small number of systems, and then almost overnight, like many applications that are out there, it exploded like a virus. You know, it just went everywhere. And unfortunately, I don't think early on that it was designed for the size and the scale and the growth that it achieved. And now we have a fundamental problem. We, meaning really Microsoft, has a fundamental problem. How do they fix architectures and reduce downtime in upgrade? Because Microsoft doesn't want you to be down for a weekend to upgrade the product. And unfortunately, some of the changes they would have to make with the architecture would require downtime and offline time to fix. And so it's very hard. They're actually kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place because they want to minimize downtime. They want to keep performance better. And changing some of these things like GUIDs as clustering keys that are very fragmented and so forth. It's very challenging to do that in a short period of time. And it's tough. It's really tough. I don't know if that helps. Did you want to say more?
No, you covered
it. You're so empathetic. I appreciate that.
Yes, that was why I wanted the mic first.
Get this gentleman here. You had a question?
Yes. So now that I hear that, okay, if you have this issue, turn this trace flag on. You have that one.
Which
that
trace flag?
Yeah, trace flags.
Oh, sorry.
So what's the limit? Is there a limit where now you're, all of them start, you know, conflicting each other and not doing good than bad?
Okay, so conflicts or even just should you turn trace flags? Yeah, that's Bob. Yeah,
no, sure. Way? I mean, I'll just be honest with you in general. We really don't really try to go out there and build features based on trace flags. We don't do that on purpose, seriously. And in some cases, you've seen us actually create fixes for problems based on trace flags. A lot of that's due to limit the scope that a fix we might make, like in a hot fix, might affect a lot of users, right? 41.99, Paul just mentions a great example, where in 16, that 41.99 is part of compatibility level now, right? So it is fair for you to say that, am I worried about having multiple trace flags and one could cause conflict with the other? That is fair because we don't build those things every single time with the thought of, oh, let's build this one. We have to worry about 10 others you might turn on. That's actually a fair comment. So my general statement is you have to carefully consider every single one of those you turn on for the impact that they could have. And we do have guidance. I'll just give you my thinking on this. Every officially supported trace flag comes from two sources. One is from the documentation and one is from knowledge base articles from CSS. And that's it. Anything else outside of that, even if I show it in a deck or something, that's not officially supported.
Oh, I consider that supported.
Oh, I see. Paul said he considered it supported. If I mention to you in a deck, it's usually,
if you say in a deck, that means I can blog about it.
I see. Seriously. So we take those very seriously. And really, there's not a boatload of those, right? There's not a ton of those from the docs or the articles that actually exist in production today. Does that help you a little bit?
Can I add one more thing?
Sure. Just to add one thing, I can't think off the top of my head of a combination of supported trace flags that could cause an issue. To be honest. Now, I know for sure there are undocumented ones because I used to work for the team and I know a whole bunch of trace flags. There are ones where you turn a few of them on and your server is going to do all kinds of horrible things. But the supported ones and the ones that product support might tell you to turn on just in a really esoteric case to help you with your specific workload to work around an issue, I can't think of any combinations that are going to cause problems for you.
I'm sure it depends again, but hyper-threading. I always been under the impression there were two trains of thought. Good for SQL Server, bad for SQL Server. It depends?
My experience has been hyper-threaded just fine with SQL Server.
We are talking about the new hyper-threading, not the 2000 brain damage hyper-threading.
Yeah.
And if you still have one, because one of the reasons people have problem with hyper-threading is there was two versions of it, right? The old P4C core had problems, yeah. And turning that on was just a good way to make your machine go really slow.
I always thought that
I think it's fine.
I always thought you still only had one methodology to get to that processor, and if you had two things trying to get to what it thought was a different processor, you had a queue.
Yeah, and you saw today in the deck I showed about Autosoft NUMA how we make specific decisions as much as possible to avoid scheduling threads on the same physical core. So we do that. It's possible where all the actual logical CPUs are being executed, that can happen. But we make conscious decisions to try to avoid that as much as we can.
Okay. Go ahead. Just to add to that. So in the past, when hyperthreading initially came out, it could be really sucky and really bad for you. Okay. And so what we still hear nowadays are server admins who were used to that still hold the view that hyperthreading is bad and you're not going to turn it on. Nowadays, though, the default is turn on hyperthreading for SQL servers.
Yeah. And I think it's a residual of that to that aughts version of hyperthreading that really did have a lot of trouble.
Oh, that's a long time ago.
That's a long time ago. Yeah. I have a question for Kimberly. In one of your sessions, you mentioned you were developing some indexing material for Pluralsight. When do you think that'll be available?
Oh, man, you're going to make me put this on a recording. Damn. Did you pay him off for this?
Coming up in a couple of weeks,
Kim. It depends, yes.
Yeah.
So when it comes to recording, right, especially something like a Pluralsight course, I'm terribly...
Slow
is good, yes. But I look at things like 400 times before I get to the point where I'm going to, so I'm terribly slow. That's absolutely true. The next course I'm working on is an indexing course and a statistics course. And the first part of the indexing course is probably going to be 8 to 10 hours. But I'm even already estimated another 10 to 20 hours after that. So it is on my plate. I am planning. I've actually got the framework of the first course already, and I even did it as my pre-con. That's not exactly the format, but that's kind of the content. And I probably could have gone 3 hours more than my pre-con.
No.
Shut up. Yeah, everybody's against me here. So my point is, I'm getting there for the first course, and I'm hoping to actually record that very soon. So I'm actually hoping.
That's a cop out saying very soon.
Soon is relative. What, do you want me to say like Tuesday?
Dates, Kimberly. Right? All about the dates.
Which Tuesday? No, but I really do hope that I'm going to get it recorded this month. This month meaning November. Sorry, it's not quite. Next month. So November, so that we can get it into production. It still takes a little bit of time after that for them to dot the I's, cross the T's, get it out there. But hopefully the next couple of months, Okay.
And if this recording is in November, then you do December.
Oh, good point. Yeah. Just next month. Richard, I'll pay you off to delay this
will.
Till like February.
I'll just keep slipping the release of this show. All right, we got another question.
We're extensively using the columns or the cluster columns store in an analytic environment, which is working really well, by the way.
So 14 or cluster columns store in 16?
In 14, yeah. So we do run into an occasional problem where you have too many large queries all running at once, and the memory grants get to the point where they consume all the memory on the server, which brings query performance, makes it maybe like 30 times worse during the duration of those queries. Short of adding more memory or finding a way to throttle that many large queries from running at once, is there anything we could potentially do to mitigate that?
So in those particular scenarios, is it specific to only when you're running column store?
Yes.
Because typically memory grant problems, what I've seen issues are, is an estimation problem, right? So when we do estimations for query plans, if the estimation's off, we're going to base the grant based on that estimated number of rows. And that could be huge, right? So then what happens is you come along and run your query and the actual use of the number, the actual estimation, the actuals are off, the actuals are much smaller, and the usage is lower. So typically what we do is use resource governor. Resource governor is an option to actually limit the amount of grants that would occur in those cases. But, well, you could, Krim mentioned you could recompile, but the biggest thing we try to do to limit the initial thing is like a resource governor, but then you have to go look at those plans and find out what is actually causing the estimations to be off, right?
So you are using recompile.
Yeah, we're using recompile on those statements, and it does appear to be getting a pretty accurate memory grant.
Okay.
It's just a very
so
large
it's
amount
just
of data. Yeah.
The amount of memory, the number of queries. Well, unfortunately, if your estimates are good and your plans are good and individually those plans are correct, I would argue that you've got a bigger workload than your machine. I mean, if your problem was the estimates were wrong and the grants were wrong and things were messed up, I would say we have to look at that, but you're already recompiling. I would potentially argue if there is some way for SQL to maybe, have you noticed batch mode processing? Have you been looking? So you're getting batch mode. So one of the things that might be interesting is segment elimination. Have you looked into this, or are any of your data sets querying subsets of the data, or is it always kind of the whole data set? Because you said billions of rows.
It really depends on the query that's being
issued.
See,
now you said it depends.
Yeah, some of them are really full table scans depending on what they're looking at, but. Yeah, we are looking at ways
I'm kind of hearing you need a bigger box. I'm sorry. I wish I could tell you that there was magic there, but if your queries are accessing billions of rows and then there are lots of them and the estimates are good and the grants are good and then you're still running into problems, it sounds like a resource problem ultimately.
Yeah.
So
yeah, we're looking at ways to throttle it to maybe spread it out, but short of adding more memory, which we may have to do. But,
Yeah,
I'm
mean,
sorry. More hardware is a great answer. It's actually going to make a difference.
Yeah, I wish I got kickbacks from, Dell and so forth, but I don't. So it does sound like a bigger box. Yeah.
The only time I'm unhappy adding new hardware is when it doesn't make a difference, right? Like, I'm all over that. If we can actually make hardware make a difference, I'll do that any day.
Yeah, and I'm all over architecting a better solution to more effectively use the hardware
Absolutely.
That I have. But it doesn't sound like any of the...
Doesn't it sound like you taking that machine to the limit? Congratulations.
Yeah,
it's
well done.
Red
well
hot.
Done. Yeah, it's a tough one. It's
got another question here.
This is a less technical question, but as a relatively new DBA, one of the challenges I have is that we've got a lot of old SQL 2005, even 2000 databases. What arguments would you give me to convince the developers that we really need to get off of those onto newer releases?
You said 2000 and 2005. Well, here's the first answer. We don't support those anymore.
That's something.
We don't even create security fixes anymore for those things, right? So, I mean, we probably would, I guess, if it was that bad. But that's the number one reason right there. If you have a catastrophic problem with those servers, good luck trying to get support. We don't even do it. You wouldn't even accept your phone call. I'm sorry. We wouldn't. Even if you tried to get through, we wouldn't actually do it. So that's the number one reason out of the gate right there.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, there's other huge differences, right, in 2008 and 16, the versions we talked about. But the number one reason, we don't support those versions anymore.
An awfully old piece of software. There's no two ways about it.
Let me add one other thing. The migration shouldn't be that horrible in a lot of cases for general code from 2000, 2005 up to another version. I mean, a little bit of testing, like in the developer edition, even just to see how things run would be a great way to just test to see if it would work. But it's likely to not be a huge problem. Keywords maybe, but do some testing and you might actually be able to move up a lot easier than people think. I mean,
and
yes.
There was a comment within the group here too that I think is a really strong one about just if you're in an audited environment of any reason, you're under any regulations of any kind,
yeah.
The
great
unsupported
point.
Gear, this is a big deal. Right? Like that could fail an audit right there. And all of a sudden it's on the boardroom table. It's no longer in the basement with the servers. So there's plenty of reasons.
Oh, and
here.
Tim wants to add something.
So I just wanted to add, prior to joining SQL Skills, I worked for a financial institution and we upgraded over 4,000 databases from SQL Server 2000. From when I started with the team, we had one 2005 database and I quickly upgraded it to 2008 R2. But out of those 4,000 plus databases, only encountered one that we could not upgrade from 2000 to 2005 because the application checked for the version to see that it was 8.0. And it was hard-coded, compiled, and we couldn't change that. But outside of that, there were just minor things from some syntax and so forth that we had to make changes to. So I would say even if Microsoft doesn't support SQL 2000, 2005, if your vendor says, well, we don't support 2005, 2008, you're unsupported regardless. So which would you rather encounter?
You know, Tim, you could have taken a hex editor to that executable and changed 8.0 to 9.0.
Clever.
Just saying.
Yeah. Still running that application, so we can go back
and check. Nice.
There you go.
Question up here.
Hi, I'm a DBA, and this is more of a political issue question. My team is getting ready to upgrade or install SQL 2016, but the setup is blowing up on Windows 2012 R2. But I've been trying the past 3 days and looking for some documented material on how to successfully install 2016 SQL on Windows 2012 R2. It's just blowing up. My question is, do you have any resources? Because the people at my job who signs the checks, they're afraid of getting into Windows 2016 because of the change in the core-based licensing.
Sure.
So my question is there a resource out there? Because I'm having a meeting with them next Tuesday, trying to convince them how to justify the cost. Is there a comparative cost analysis between 2012 R2 and justifying the cost of going to 2016 for VP types?
But yeah. So the setup problems is not your issue, it's just more of looking at the costs? Or?
That's a technical part of the issue, and I would like to move to 2016 Windows and sure. SQL 2016 because I understand they were designed to run better together. But
yeah, certainly SQL 2016 was designed. It runs well on Windows Server 2012 and Windows 2012 R2 and now on Windows Server 2016. As far as your setup problem, get an immediate case up with the support team, our Microsoft support team. Those guys will handle immediately any of your setup type issues you're running into. So if you're just trying to move forward to do that. But one consideration for you, I mean, what version are you trying to install? What edition of SQL 2016?
Enterprise.
Is that to do a production workload or are you just trying to do some proof of concepts?
It's supposed to be a production system, but okay. I've been having trouble.
Well, first of all, get a support ticket immediately open for that production system. But if you're trying to do some proof of concepts, developer edition's free. Yeah. So you can download that on any type of machine and start doing some testing, which has the full enterprise feature set to show off some of the functionality. And we do have some very good documentation comparing feature sets of why 16 is a better proposition for you. But it runs well on any of those Windows versions that you just mentioned.
I was able to install 2016 developer on my Windows 10 without any problems. But right. on a 2012 R2 server, a data center edition, that's where the setup is blowing.
But we have plenty of customers that have made that successful. So it's something specific to your environment. You get a support ticket up immediately and they'll help you out.
But do you have a resource that I can point use for the VP so that I can justify
the justification? Send me an email on bobward@microsoft.com and I will give you actually a very specific resource that will help you.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. Yeah.
All right, question over here.
Hi. Sometimes we hear and read some recommendations about if you have fast disks and a lot of buffer, you don't have to worry about fragmentation. What do you guys think about this?
So the question is, I've read some justifications that say if you have fast disks, you don't have to care about index fragmentation anymore. Okay. My hot button. One of my hot buttons.
And we say fast disks, like you're talking SSDs.
SSD. Let's just say SSDs.
You know?
So, right. So the let's take a step back and say, what is fragmentation? So there's two kinds of fragmentation. There's what's called logical fragmentation, where your pages are out of order. And this affects the ability of the read-ahead portion of a scan to do larger reads when it's pre-reading pages into the buffer pool. So the second part of fragmentation is having a lot of empty space on pages. Now let's think about why that happens. It's because what causes fragmentation in general is an operation called a page split. Right. So some space is needed on a page in an index for whatever reason. Let's just say an insert into a leaf level page of a clustered index and there isn't enough space. So SQL Server determines that there isn't enough space and it splits the page in half, basically. Generalization. Most of the time it's a 50-50 page split. Which means you've got two pages with 50% free space. The new page that gets allocated that has the second half of the rows from the original page, what do you think the odds are of that page being able to be the very next physical page in the data file from the one that's splitting? Basically zero. So it's somewhere off in the file group. So that means you've got two pages now that have 50% free space, and you've also got a page that's out of order. So you've got the wasted space on pages problem, and you've also got the read-ahead scans have to essentially be a little bit slower because they're doing more IOs.
Out of order, you mean out of disk order?
I mean out of disk order, right? Because a read-ahead scan will drop back and do smaller IOs if it finds that the pages are not in the same logical or key and physical order. So the argument goes, if you have SSDs, you don't care about any of these things. And it's complete crap. Okay.
I'm a little bit more politically correct on this. It's not complete crap. Yes, it is. Hold on. There is some...
No, there isn't.
Let me... Okay. You don't have the expense in the random IOs. So you could argue that it is helping solve part of the problem. But what's crap is that there's lots of other aspects of it that aren't solved. And he's still going to...
See, even when it's my question, she still has to speak. So the argument goes that SSDs are so fast that it doesn't matter that we're doing smaller IOs because SSDs are so fast. However, even if you're doing faster IOs... and more IOs, okay, so the actual IO time might be smaller, you're still burning a whole bunch more CPU time because you're making more trips down and up the IO stack, okay? So it doesn't solve that problem. And Jonathan's got a blog post that actually proves, using very advanced metrics, that that is untrue. Having an SSD doesn't solve the free space or the wasted space problem, obviously, okay? But here's the big kicker. When a page split occurs, everything that it does... So allocating the new page, moving the rows to the new page, fixing up all the linkages within the B tree is fully logged, no matter what recovery model you're in. Page splits are insanely expensive in terms of the amount of transaction log that's generated. And having an SSD doesn't stop page splits. So you've still got all that transaction log being generated, which means you've got the perf hit of the page split, right? And most people, when they think about fragmentation, they just think, oh, it's slowing down my scans. I need to defrag it. They don't think, how did I get here? You got here because you already took a perf hit from the page splits happening. And SSDs don't stop that in any way whatsoever. Right? In fact, there is no scenario where you don't care about index fragmentation. You always have to care about index fragmentation, no matter what. Is that a strong enough answer?
You can clap for that. That's
definitely fun. A hot button.
I'm pretty passionate.
No worries. Last 5 minutes. Final questions?
Question for Kimberly.
Question for Kimberly. We don't have enough time.
All right. Along the same lines where somebody came and said, you know, just throw some more hardware at it. I had a pretty bad experience with an application, a .NET Entity Framework application, where the development team had insisted on going through a code-first development cycle. Thank you. You answered my question right
yes.
there. Just the
faster you start coding, the longer it's going to take and worse your performance will be.
Well, and when it generated the database, what I saw on the back end was, you know, a complete nightmare. And all these things up here, data type choices and everything. But I guess maybe more my point, maybe I should be asking this in the other room to the .NET people is, you know, why are there being these tools built that encourage rapid application development when we all know that sooner or later our apps have to work with databases and, you know, why can't we get them working together?
This is a Richard question.
Nice. Yes! This is unusual. A little bit of a switch hit. I mean, there are a bunch of development tools out there that are designed to build code very rapidly to get something out into the field that will have consequences if it scales. That is not an anomalous thing.
You mean it won't scale, therefore the consequence is disastrous.
Yes. And so, I mean, one of the arguments always is, it's like, if I don't get this thing out the door soon, there's going to be any money to do anything about it anyway. Right? So, I was smiling as soon as you started the question. It's like, wow, ask a room of DBAs how much they like code first. I wonder how that's going to go. Right? And let's be very clear, guys, you know, as I've been a DBA, I'm being rehabilitated. We have a lot of ways in the development world to store data these days. There is a diversity. An awful lot of systems we're seeing where they're taking the objects they're creating and just sticking them on the disk transactionally, but undecomposed at the time of the transaction. And then post facto decomposing it into a relational database. And post facto meaning milliseconds later, but primarily after the connection to the customer is gone, so that they can reduce that front-end cost of the communicating to the customer, right? They insist on making objects in the first place. We can debate that all day long. So why not just store the object first and then go from there? It is normal in software development, in my experience of an obnoxiously number of large years at this point, to build the bad version first. See, and then iterate.
My issue there, though, is that it never just lasts for 3 months. It's never just a prototype.
Nope.
It's never, it goes into production and then it hobbles along. And when you've got a bad schema, all that code on top of it is incredibly difficult to change. Because if you touch the schema in any way, you have to change all of that code. So we just hobble along. And some of those design decisions, like even just data types, because you said data types, it's a fantastic discussion. I talked about that in one of my sessions. Like if you make a bad decision on a clustering key, the repercussions of that are huge, right? That clustering key goes into the non-key. Yeah, he's like, step aside. She's going to go off on a tangent here. But so... that clustering key goes into the non-clusters. It bloats the non-clusters. It costs you in everything you do. And I guess my frustration is that let's get it out there and we'll deal with performance later. Or let's get it out there to make sure that people want it to be out there. Well, once it's out there and people want it to be out there, getting a better thing out there becomes an almost impossibility. And then trying to fix what's out there is also very difficult. So we keep throwing hardware at it. And that helps, but it just hobbles along. So,
well, and believe me, the database is not special in this scenario. Let's get it out there and we'll deal with security later. You know, let's get it out there and we'll deal with usability later. You know, that is the normal mantra and the business buys in, right? These typically are decisions made above our pay grade for better or worse.
I think a hybrid of those two is not only possible, but not that problematic in terms of let's get it out there in a little bit more time.
Right.
I'm not saying 7 years, which I know would happen, but, you know, in some cases, instead of getting out there in 2 months, let's get out there in 2.5 months. Let's spend a couple of days talking to stakeholders, defining the domain of legal values, defining good data types. Let's take 6 or 8 of the most key, critical, early decisions, and let's make good ones. Then we can do the rest of the stuff.
And I'm going to support you on that, especially in today's culture.
I love you, Richard.
I love you too, sweetie. Where... this is, when we really talk about this whole DevOps movement and so forth, what we're really talking about is making sure that all the people who are ultimately going to be impacted about these decisions are in the room when they're made.
Exactly.
And so I would argue this, having, you know, played these different roles, be very sure you know why you weren't in the room. Because often they have trouble trusting us, right? That we're not on their call list for, we're working on a design problem, we should make sure the DBA is in the room. Do yourself a favor. Break down those barriers. Have some way that they feel like talking to you in the first place. Because you could actually make them go faster, not slower. We just got to get in there in time.
Really quick. Will the stakeholders that want the quick solution going to still be around for the painful fix later?
Goodness, no. That's just crazy.
And that is the most critical piece, in my opinion.
We have now lit the room up, and it's the end of time. Let's adjourn to the bar, because this is even more fun with beer. Thank you, folks, for coming out. Have a big hand for our, quote, panelists. And we'll talk to you next time on Run-As Radio.